Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Fred. I am responsible. I am accountable. I am capable of assisting people to find their true voice and then deliver it effectively into the world around us. With 40 years in mental health, 32 of them as a psychiatrist, and then a massive amount of conversations, including podcasting and expert speaking, keynote speaking, I have the opportunity to really see the magic that it takes to find one's authentic self and then deliver it effectively into the world. And if you're like me, you can see that now more than ever, that's what's called for. So today is that day. Now is that time. Come forth. Join me in the broadcast. You'll see on the other side of this, a true voice with Dr. Fred.
All right. Welcome, everyone. I am Sam Morris. I am Dr. Fred's frequent co-host, and today I will be hosting this show alone. Fred Moss, turns out, had to go through a medical emergency that he has had to deal with, and I'm wishing him my absolute best. Sounds like he's in good shape and in good hands. So today I will be talking shit behind his back this entire time, and he'll just have to deal with that. Love you, Fred. If you're listening to this later, you're, of course, in good hands. Today I have a guest who is joining me, Harry Sherwood, and I actually just met for the first time yesterday, and when he told me his story and what he is up to, I thought he would be a great guest to bring on the podcast today, and we're going to find out about Harry and Harry's life and a very unique direction and path that Harry is about to embark on in the coming month, I believe. I believe this starts in just about a month. But before we get there, I want to talk with Harry, get to know Harry a little bit, and allow this audience to get to know Harry a little bit. So without further ado, welcome, Harry Sherwood. Great to see you.
Yes, thank you for having me on. Definitely the quickest podcast I've ever been on after speaking to someone so soon, a 24-hour turnaround. So
I think it was like pretty much exactly 24 hours, isn't it? You're like, do you happen to have any podcasts that you know about? I'm like, actually, let's get you on a podcast tomorrow. How does that sound?
So yep, and here I am. So thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So Harry is, you're in Palos Verdes, California. What brought you there, Harry? I haven't really discussed that with you. What brought you to Palos Verdes?
I grew up here. I moved out here when I was five, been here, left for travels, kind of came back, left again, came back. I just keep seeming to end up here. And every time I come back, there's more appreciation for the nature, the weather, the privacy and everything. So I keep gravitating back towards it, and I enjoy it quite a bit.
And if you were to take us back to maybe a time in the history of Harry Sherwood that you feel is relevant for kind of how you got here today, our lives, if we look at the linear time frame of the course of our lives, there's any place that we could sort of pick up on. What are some of the things that have informed who you are today, and how much of that is relative to geography? How much of that is relative to what you've learned along the way? I know that's a very general and vague question, but you can dive in anywhere you want there.
Yeah, there's a lot of different kind of things that come up there. I'll start where there was the most pivotal time in my life, and then I could go either direction from there. But after high school, so in high school, I was kind of almost the movie-esque jock partier,
really
sleeping around with women, getting in fights, wasn't a bully, which is good to say, but the rest of it kind of fit. And I, quite frankly, I enjoyed it. It was a good time. And there was a part of me that was deeply insecure. Mm. And there was a part of me that felt very like I was wasting my time. Every time I woke up with a hangover, there was just my organism was telling me I'm supposed to be doing something else. There's a richness to life that I am missing. And that wore on me enough to where I was going to go to the University of Arizona and go party for four more years and repeat the cycle. And I decided not to. And so I stayed back. I went to a JC, went and coached high school football, and took time to get to know myself. That's when I started to meditate, started to get into spirituality more sincerely, started to do MMA, and really wanted to figure out who I was. Not sure I would have put it in those terms at that time, but it was a big pivotal moment, because within a year and a half, that led me to traveling the world and living with monks in China, living with monks in the States. And it was this moment of, I can't keep doing this, that did create such a huge life trajectory shift.
That seems like a radical transition, and a lot more of a radical transition than you typically hear. Like, I've heard, most, if not all, adolescents have a certain degree of insecurity, and they evolve and become a different version of themselves, and sometimes a drastically different version of themselves than they were when they were in high school. But we're talking about, seems like a pretty radical turn. What was the impetus behind that? What were the thoughts and feelings that were associated with that transition?
When I was younger, there was something about what I would call the mystical or the magical or the otherworldly or the spiritual, that always touched me in a way that nothing else did. Like when the magician pulled guessed my card and it was right, there was just 10 seconds. There was a moment of awe and of anything's possible and of goosebumps and this inner stirring of my soul or my energy in a way that always just really impacted me. Or watching The Lord of the Rings and seeing Gandalf, or learning about the wizard or the wizard archetype, or those types of things always just hit me in a way that nothing else did. And so that, mixed with dynamics in my family unit, which I can get into, and the specific type of programming and trauma that I had leading to that insecurity and stuff, like, just it kind of was a perfect storm.
If you're comfortable in exploring some of that, I'm sure there's probably some people listening who could relate or whatever. So if you're comfortable exploring that, I'd love to dive into that a little bit.
Yeah. So I think the short story there, and we can keep double clicking, is that one of my primary stories or one of my primary traumas was a feeling of not being enough, a feeling that I had to actually do something externally in order to gain my worth and gain my value and really gain the attention and the affection of my dad in the way that he also valued, in the way that he also lived his life. He Palos Verdes is an affluent area. He made a lot of money, and that's kind of how he gained his parents' approval, and so on and so forth. So it became this having to, like, not feeling an inherent value in myself and perceiving myself in that way caused, a specific type of relationship to self, a specific type of anxiety, a specific type of shame, and all these things that would kind of compile with the insecurity and kind of feed that insecurity as well. And then there's offshoots of it, right? There's different kind of dynamics between my mom and myself and my brothers and myself. And one of my brothers, an addict, and the other one was kind of had massive anger issues and stuff. And so there was just different things that were occurring how I dealt with it was was disconnecting and dissociating from them and running into my friend group at school, and we became super close, and that's where the partying and all that happened. And so I dealt by avoiding. And so when it came to 18, and when I started making this decision, and then when I finally went to China at 19, it was a mixture between this awe and following this kind of this mystical calling with also, I have to get away from my family, from the culture that I grew up in, from the Western world. Like, I had to run away from it. Literally went to the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And fortunately, it wound up being a running away, but also a running towards.
Mm.
And that really worked out for me, because I know a lot of people who run away and they'll run into a brick wall, or they'll just run into something super unhealthy. This wound up being very healthy for me. Even though there's been years of therapy involved and all sorts of stuff as well.
Yeah. I'm curious how you had that knowing even at that age. And if that's something that it sort of came into higher resolution later, in terms of, say, the juxtaposition between receiving your value and your acknowledgement from the external world, like you said, sort of validating through your father's approval, and he was validating through his father's approval, versus the juxtaposition of knowing on some deeper level that that was a dead end road, and that that would be a conditional form of love, and that you needed to find something else. Like, did you know at the time that there was a rift between that aspect of you that was striving to receive value from the external world and through your accomplishments, and that inner sense of self? Or was it just like, something's painful inside of me and I need something different and I need to get away from this pain? How would you describe that knowing? Or was it just a sense of, I just got to get out of here?
Yeah, much more the latter. I couldn't have articulated what I just did at that age. Mm-hmm. The pain was there, and it was more of a sense of being lost, because also a part of the dynamic between me and my dad and my mom as well, but more my dad, was just that he wasn't around very often. And so I felt lost. I felt without guidance. I felt like, and that played into me not knowing who I was, and then, you know, trying to be and gain worth and value when I don't even know which way is up is a compounding effect. And so at that time, it was just kind of like, I have to get away from what is and find something that sparks me in a different way. So like, yeah, at the time it was just like, I don't know if I could have said anything more than that. It was just, that looks really cool and I really want to do it. And it feels mystical, like a spiritual quest.
Yeah.
And I know I just have to get away from what's here.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what was it that seemed so cool and so mystical about the China experience? This was age 19, is that what you said?
Yes. So this was in 2010, age 19. So a friend of my brother's, as I was putting this, it was a gap year. So I took a year off. And as I was putting this year together, I talked to my brother's friend who had been to Shaolin in China to study Kung Fu. And he's like, hey, man, you should check this out. It sounds like this would be potentially up your alley. Because at that point, he knew I was meditating and doing some stuff. And so I wound up going to a slightly different place than he did. But I went to a cultural and martial arts school and studied Tai Chi and Qigong and with Shaolin monks. And for me, like, you know, watching Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon or Hero or those types of movies, again, always spoke to me. So I was like, you know, I want to go see if they're floating an arrow over there. It was kind of I want to go find out.
Right.
And that felt very mystical to me. And then I also, the second half of that year, I went to a self-realization fellowship ashram in Escondido, California, called Hidden Valley.
Paramahansa Yogananda.
Mm-hmm. Paramahansa Yogananda, yes. And that was actually the meditation I had started doing. And I grabbed the pamphlet for Hidden Valley, actually for my brother, who just wasn't in a good place. And it was just sitting in my drawer for like 6 months collecting dust, because he just wasn't going to go. And when I was putting this together, I opened the drawer and it was just right in front of me. I said, well, maybe I go. Maybe I go do this. And so that was phase one and two of that year. And it was very spiritually oriented, which fed my soul, which was what I needed.
Mm-hmm. So phase one was, let me just make sure I get this timeline correct. Phase one was self-realization fellowship. Phase two was China. Is that what I'm gathering?
Or
the inverse.
Yes.
China and then self-realization
fellowship. China and then self-realization. Yeah.
Got it. So describe your experience in China. What was that like?
So I wound up staying in China for 4 months, and I was at an international cultural and martial arts school where all of the teachers or shifus were Chinese. Only one of them spoke English. So my teacher didn't speak a lick of English, and I spoke so little Mandarin that basically for 4 months, I learned from him through the universal language of energy and just, you know, mimicking what he did. And he'd come over and correct me, and you know, there would be noises or grunts or just, you know, the unspoken body language and the other things that we would communicate through, which is really amazing. And it was 8 hours a day of training. So it was pretty intensive where we'd be up at, I forget at this point, maybe seven or something in the morning, we'd go on up. There was a mountain we were next to. You'd go run up the mountain and come back down, do your stretches, and then go to the training hall and break for lunch and do that pretty much all day.
Oh my God. This sounds straight out of a movie. I mean, it's kind of the way that it's supposed to be in the Kung Fu movie, you know? And was it Kung Fu that you were training in, or was it a different martial art?
So I was Tai Chi mostly. Tai Chi, and then I did some Qigong, which is kind of more just energetic movement. Mm-hmm. Within that, it's interesting because in part of how I describe it, totally, it is like the picturesque Kung Fu movie, and yet there was the modern and also the other parts of maybe the movie they don't show that were very present, which was where we were. The poverty level was beyond what I had seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And there was a woman, I mean, first of all, they don't have like the same type of dealing with their trash and recycling that we do, so they would just pile it about 10 feet high and then burn it. And that was tons of pollution would be involved there. There was a woman, there was a small crop of corn who lived next to it. And she just, one side of her house was about 3 feet high of bricks. The other side was just like a wooden pole and a tarp over it. And that's where she lived 24/7 and, you know, had half of her teeth. And so it was this kind of like shocking disparity of like a lot of the places wherever you turn. But then this like very mystical, beautiful experience simultaneously. So it was different than what I expected, which was really good for me in a lot of ways. It wasn't as spiritual as I thought it was going to be. One thing that really struck me was that most of the martial arts that they practice there now are performative. It is, you know, out of the thousands of kids that are born into it, the best will go on tour and be the Shaolin monks that you go see at like Cirque du Soleil or something like that. And most of them don't really ever make it. And the ones that are pretty good become teachers. But the depth of Buddhism involved wasn't really at least centralized where I was. I'm sure it is in other places. And I remember talking to one of the teachers, and his comment was, you know, I'd love to just get an education. I stopped halfway through grade school because of like, basically you train here to try to be the best. That's it.
Now, when you say it wasn't as spiritual as you expected it to be, I'm curious, is that a qualitative experience? Like, what are the metrics that you had or have internally for evaluating the degree of sort of spiritualness of the experience? Was it that there is little emphasis on philosophy, mindfulness? Was it that you felt that the teachers maybe weren't as connected to something qualitatively as you were anticipating? Where does that come from?
Yeah, I would say both of those. There just wasn't much focus on it at all. To the point of when we did go in, because every once in a while we'd go into the meditation hall and do maybe 20 or 30 minutes of meditation, but that was maybe once a week. They actually had me teach it because I knew meditation coming in. And the only one who spoke English didn't really practice all that much. So there was this like, oh, okay, this isn't, whereas my time at the ashram, we were meditating hours a day. The whole focus was spirituality. Sundays were all in silence with 6 hour meditation sits, like very different focal point. So
back
it was
at Self-Realization Fellowship in Encinitas. So let's go there now. Let's talk about that. So you came back from China. You spent how much? 6 months in China? Is that what it was?
It was supposed to be 6 months, but I got dysentery twice and it turned out to be pretty intense. So I came back a couple months early, which turned out to be perfect because during that month and a half I had in between, I actually applied to transfer to the University of Michigan, and that's where I went after the ashram. So it worked out well.
Okay.
But then I landed in Hidden Valley for 6 months. And that was what I expected in some ways. It was more than I expected. And in fact, I would say that was probably up until that point in my life, the first time I'd ever said that about an experience that was an extended experience of this actually transcended what I was hoping for. It was so deeply immersed in spirituality, enlightenment, how to connect, techniques, an entire community who's living this way, 50-year monks who are profoundly walking their talk. Like it was so rich it was transformative in a lot of different ways too.
And when you say techniques, were we talking about sort of spiritual technologies through meditation, or what exactly are the techniques can you describe some of them? Are these secret techniques that get passed down only to the initiated? What was the nature of the techniques that you would practice?
So Yogananda left behind kind of what he calls lessons, and there's tons of lessons. And in the lessons, you kind of learn a progressive amount of techniques. And some of them are free to the public. Some of them you only learn in the lessons. And then there is an initiatory point where it's called Kriya Yoga. If you want to take Yogananda on as your guru in the lineage of SRF, as your lineage, then you learn Kriya Yoga. And that's kind of the secret technique, so to say. So kind of all of the above there. Some of them are very mindfulness-based and breath-based. Some of them are energetic movements. They have energization exercises, is what they call them, which is very Tai Chi-esque, where it's just, you move and you're connecting to the energy of your being as you're doing that, and you're creating flow in that, so that when you go and sit in meditation, you have more access to that inner energy source. So there's kind of various ones that approach the self and meditation and connection in different ways.
And how would you describe a before and after experience so that someone listening to this can say, well, why would I practice those techniques myself? What's the benefit that you've experienced through the practice of these techniques that has been so profoundly life-changing for you, assuming that it has been profoundly life-changing?
Yeah, that's a semi-difficult question to answer, only because it's hard to separate from doing the techniques alone versus doing the techniques in an ashram with monks versus doing the techniques later on in life as I'm also doing somatic psychotherapy or plant medicine or Lakota Song Circle or these, it's like I've always coupled them or tripled them with other types of growth oriented factors. Mm-hmm. So it is hard to isolate like this technique begot this response specifically. But I would say that during my time there, the two most impactful things that happened were, number one, it was so much more difficult than I thought it was going to be, because all of my coping mechanisms, or at least a lot of my external coping mechanisms, were no longer there. I couldn't go and turn on the TV or go, shoot the shit with someone or all of these different ways that I distracted myself from having to face myself and to feel myself. And so there was a lot of moments where it was overwhelmingly difficult to the point of like, whoa, I didn't expect anything near how intense this is. Mm. And then on the other side of the coin, about 2 months in, I had what I would call my first mystical experience. And that in some ways kind of took the fire that was and turned up the gas, and it was just threw some logs on the fire. And then I didn't have them every day, but there were breadcrumbs, as I call them, throughout those 6 months of these different types of altered states of consciousness that would start to come in, that really kind of showed me like, oh, this is real. This is possible. Mm-hmm. This thing that was philosophy, this path to enlightenment that was just philosophical for me, mm-hmm. And was fascinatingly interesting, was starting to actually sink its teeth in a little bit, starting mm-hmm. to show me like, whoa, okay, something just happened. I don't know what it was. Mm-hmm. I hope it comes back, mm-hmm. Type of thing. So I kind of had, very polarized in some ways, like intensity and pain to awe and beauty beyond mm-hmm. what I had also experienced thus far. So, mm-hmm. and the techniques definitely played a role in, those mystical states coming up.
So stepping into the embodiment, having an intellectual and philosophical understanding that eventually moved through your commitment, through your practice, through staying with the stuff that you didn't want to feel long enough on a regular enough dedicated basis, you're able to have some real embodied experience of a freedom that transcended what you even thought was possible prior to getting into this.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way of saying it. And I think a simple way is just the concept or the idea started to become embodied and experienced. And it's the, Morpheus telling Neo, there's a difference between knowing the path and walking the path. And I was starting to walk the path. And it was just, you can describe what an apple tastes like to the nth degree, and no one will ever know what it actually tastes like till they bite into it, type of thing. And so I was mm-hmm. starting to bite into the apple and saying, oh, I enjoy this. I think I'm going to eat more of these.
Mm. Yeah. And what words would you put to that, those experiences that you can, what types of adjectives would you apply to these experiences, and how would you describe them as dramatically different from the aspects of your former self that were in a place of suffering and discontent and existential pain?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think might be best there is just, I'll just describe the first experience that I had. Then I think that would hold a lot of those answers. So it was a couple months in to my time there. We were coming out of a 90-minute meditation. At the end of the meditation, there was like 20 people in the room, and we were chanting Om, Om, Om. And when you got 20 guys doing that for 10 minutes straight, it starts to synchronize in a really powerful way. And so I was coming back, and it was lunchtime. And so I was heading up to the place where we ate lunch, and as I was coming out, in the center of my head, there was this ringing, this wong that was happening. And it was actually disorienting to the point where like I had to slow down my walking. And as I started to slow down, it was almost as if I was wearing moon boots or like magnetized shoes. My feet were getting drawn into the ground. And I took a couple of steps and then I just surrendered to it. I just, let go and just said, I don't know what's happening, but I'm going to let it happen. And my feet locked in. And when I did, the ringing in my head just went boom, and it shot out in all directions. And it's difficult to describe, but as it went, I went with it. Like it, where Harry ended in the physical sense expanded outward. And when I opened my eyes, it was kind of like those Claritin Clear commercials where it's just so much more vivid when you use Claritin Clear, and the greens are greener and the blue of the sky is bluer. And it was incredibly vivid. And I could feel some sort of breath in the grass. Like it was breathing, but it wasn't the grass. It was me as the grass, and the grass is me. There wasn't a separating factor anymore. But it wasn't like, oh, I am everything. And it wasn't like everything. It was me. It was like both of those distinctions wouldn't be correct, because it would have been, there is only everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was my experience. And it only lasted 2 to 3 minutes.
Went from wave to ocean.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Beautiful. Yes. And these experiences were powerful enough that this has been predicated the next evolution of your life, which we are going to get to just after a quick break. So TJ, take us out for a moment, and we'll be right back.
Hello, everybody. It's Dr. Fred again. I wanted to explain to you a little bit about one of the names I have called the Undoctor. What is the Undoctor? Well, after about 15 years in the field of me being misaligned with what I was doing, because I was medicating people even knowing that medications were not the right answer, and I was diagnosing people even though I didn't always believe that they had the diagnosis that I said that they had, even though they did meet the criteria, etc., I like seeing humans for exactly who they are and who they're not, and not as a diagnosis. So in 2006, I began the process of becoming the Undoctor. I unmedicated, undiagnosed, and then undoctrinated a bunch of people. Like, people no longer had to come to a psychiatrist because their condition's cleared. This isn't true for everyone. It may not be true for you, but for some folks who know that their diagnosis doesn't fit and who know that they don't want to keep going through with medications and don't want to be seen as someone who's defective or afflicted, this turned out to be a great intervention. Over time, I stopped doing that, and I no longer do a whole lot of conventional psychiatry. Now I just help people walk through their life and find their true voice. I connect with people straight up, not as if there's a power gradient between a doctor and a patient, but it's two humans connecting and resonating with each other. As it turns out, that's where all healing emanates from. So today, I've developed the Welcome to Humanity brand over the last 6 or 7 years, and that really takes into consideration all of this. It is self-explanatory. Basically, each and every experience that we have with humanity is just as exquisite as another, even if it's deeply uncomfortable. From there, we get to actually share these human experiences. From there, we get to resonate and connect, and from there, healing takes place. I also have been helping people with their true voice, and that's why you're here today at True Voice with Dr. Frey. I help people find that true voice, really their authentic self, their core value system, and then deliver it effectively into a world that is eagerly awaiting to hear you. Without your voice, no one will ever hear you. And without your true voice, no one will ever know you. But with your true voice, you can find healing, peace, and love. True voice is what it takes to end all wars. So, welcome to True Voice with Dr. Fred.
All right. Welcome back. For anyone just joining us, this is Sam Morris sitting in for Dr. Fred Moss. We miss you, Fred. We're sending love, love hearing your voice, and sending Fred lots of healing energy. So I want to pick up where we left off, Harry, with this voyage, this journey into the deeper self, because this journey gets really exciting. And we're talking, so what we just spoke of was, what, back in 2000, 9, 10 when you went to China and then Self-Realization Fellowship. And so a lot of time has...
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
2011 was Self-Realization. 2010 was China.
Okay. And obviously a lot of time has passed since then. And we've had another 11, 12 years since then. So why don't you give us sort of the quick evolution, but then I want to really focus on the future and what you are about to embark on in a month. But give us the short story of what has evolved in the past 12 years since then.
Yeah, I want to say first that I really like that beat that is played during the intro and the commercial. I was vibing with it, so I just wanted to name
cool
that.
Yeah, cool.
So after my 6 months at the ashram, I transferred to the University of Michigan, and I got a degree in religious studies because it was the closest thing that I could think to studying what I was now interested in and what I was now starting to experience. And it was cool because they didn't have a religious studies program. So I actually got to put my own curriculum together, applied it to the board of LSNA. They okayed it. So it was a very non-traditional religious studies program. I studied a lot of psychology involved with it. I did sociology and various things, anything that had to do with spirituality or religion and its impact. I went to Ghana for a month and stayed with one of the head chiefs of the Asante Kingdom, went to Indonesia and helped facilitate a group of students abroad. All of that counted towards my major. So it was very, very great time. Then in 2014, I went back to the ashram a second time in Escondido at Hidden Valley. And that was a 5-month stay. And my time in between, I had been living the life of a monk. So when I went to university, I was celibate. I was vegetarian. I didn't drink. Because I knew that I was contemplating becoming a monk and I wanted to find out what the reality of that was. And it's funny because in some ways, like, I'm really proud of myself for that time. And in other ways, I'm like, man, that was intense. And it actually kind of burned me out. So by the time that I landed at the ashram in 2014, I was somewhat on fumes from it all because I was meditating 2 to 3 hours every day on top of being a full-time student and other things. So it was a lot. And I was going about it very willpower-esque, like I have to get this done. And it just was imbalanced is the truth of it. And so when I went back to the ashram, I spent 5 months, made the decision that I wasn't going to be a monk, even though that container was something I thrived in and I really appreciated. There was just enough calling me to the world that I left. Mm-hmm. And after that, that's really where what I would say was more of kind of like a spiritually focused path wound up, or spiritual development path wound up kind of blossoming into multiple forms of development. Because not long after that, I met a partner that I was with for 8 years. She had a lot of trauma, and that wound up getting me into a lot of more of the trauma world, learning how to be a good partner during that, getting into my own trauma and doing psychotherapy and somatic psychotherapy. And I'm also just an explorer. So I love exploring various different traditions. So I got involved over the years, and this is going to be out of order, but with Lakota Song Carrier, and I did okay. Sweat Lodge and went to Sundance I've learned lots of songs there and got involved with plant medicine and sat with everything from mushrooms to ayahuasca to toad to frog to like all the kind of various ones that are more popular these days. Mm-hmm. I got into coaching, or I got back into coaching afterwards, coming off of that season of being a football coach. I got back into sports performance coaching, started coaching CrossFit and Olympic weightlifting, and then simultaneously started teaching meditation and mindfulness afterwards. And those paralleled for three-ish years until I became a life coach and opened up a company with my partner at the time. Mm-hmm. And that led to other trainings, wound up getting certified as a HeartMath resiliency trainer, got certified in something called circling, which I'll talk about based on what we'll talk about going forward. And got involved with Gabor Mate's compassionate inquiry training and So there was just various things that were coming in that I was so much more open to. And the spiritual life was my foundation. But then I got very interested in emotional development, intellectual development, interpersonal development, egoic development, and really I'm multifaceted. We as humans are very multidimensional. How can I move the needle, not just in one area, but as a total self? And those have all been fueled by the passion for enlightenment, because it was like, hey, I got something going on here. I got a blockage here that really came in my face when I was, alone in the ashram. And while I was able to be with it to an extent, like, I need to process this. I need to understand this and deeply either pull up the root or figure out what to do with this. And I would say the only other piece about the journey there is that in doing all these things, my humanity kind of came back in. There was a repression of my humanity during those few years of the monk life.
And yeah.
A lot of people call that spiritually bypassing in some ways, where it was just like I had to block out part of Harry because I just didn't know how to be with him. But then when I found enough stability, he could come back out. And then it's just kind of been this, how do I let the goofy, imperfect, insecure guy come back while walking towards this deeper, profound connection and not see them at odds? And that's been a journey. For sure.
That's a deep, deep subject that we could discuss for several hours alone, and just that topic alone of spiritual bypass and including the self, the what we would describe as the ego self, along with this desire for transcension and not denying it, not going into spiritual bypass, all that stuff. But I want to make sure that we have time to really dive into what you are about to embark on in about a month, because this is a deeper level of commitment than most people are accustomed to. You're really about to go whole hog with your quest for enlightenment. So describe to our audience what you're about to take on.
Yeah, whole hog. I like that. I'm starting something called the Game of Presence Project. And the Game of Presence is essentially one of the things I learned along the way of becoming present in life, bringing my attention into the room, into the space that I'm inhabiting, and looking around. What else is in the room with me? What objects, what noises, what sensations, what energies, what emotions? And out of the mind, and out of the mind specifically, as it thinks about some other place in time, yesterday, all the things I have or I did do and didn't do and needed to do tomorrow, and all the things I have to do or I want to do, some fantasize or alternate life of the I wants or whatever kind of lives there, and just being here, present.
So make sure that I'm clear and that your audience and the audience is clear. You're essentially talking about being in a space. Now, someone might listen to that and be like, well, I know what it's like to be in a space. I'm in a space right now. But you're talking about being in a space with a sort of neutrality, observing your experience, observing your inner experience, observing the outer space that you're in, and not letting your mind wander to past, future, but really just being present in a neutral observing perspective. Is that clear?
Yes. And I would say that there, so within the, when you do start getting deeper into meditation techniques and mindfulness and things like that, the observer definitely becomes a part of the equation. And what I would say that would maybe even be more to the point is the experience and the experiencer, whereas wherever my attention is, I am there. Like, I'm experiencing. And so in this process, I'm essentially decoupling my experience of reality from thinking and thinking about reality. And I'm recoupling it to feeling and sensing and being in the room. Like, oh, I'm in the room right now. What does it feel like? Mm-hmm. And then to your point, whenever the mind wants to wander and my attention gets drawn elsewhere, I bring it back. Mm-hmm. I bring it back. Mm-hmm. I bring it back. And that might happen 1,000 times in a day, just one day. you know, and it's, and depending on how restless the mind is, that could happen in an hour. So it's, it takes a discipline of focus and of attention.
So back to what you're about to embark on in a month.
Yes. Yes. And so I do that. And the reason that I do that is because as I do that, I become aware of more, right? I become aware of frequencies that I might not be aware of, connections to spirit, to these more profound states that we were talking about. And so what I'm doing with the Game of Presence project is I am going to be fully stepping into this with all of my time, similar to what I did at the ashram. But I'm going to be doing it myself in where I currently live. This is going to be my cave, so to say. And it's going to be for an extended period of time. Could be 2 years, could be 10 years. I actually don't know yet. I don't want to say I must do 5 years when 5 years isn't long enough, or I must do 5 years when three is long enough. And so I want, when you do something called the Game of Presence, you kind of have to let presence be a part of the thing that tells you what's up and that tells you what's next. So yeah, I'm going whole hog, as you said, on my quest for enlightenment, deepening into these states. And there's something called the state stage kind of transition, where we often in kind of the spiritual practices will come in and out of different states of experience, whether it's energetic or it's pure consciousness or it's the void or it's non-dual or it's, you know, depending on what the lineage and what they call it, there's also different things that we can experience. And I might be there for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour, 2 days, but then I inevitably kind of come back to waking consciousness, restless mind, whatever happening naturally. And I might do that thousands of times before that actually becomes my stage of development, where I have stepped into that being my baseline. And so that is kind of what I'm seeking, is I'm seeking a baseline of this more unified connection, where the individual self that is Harry has dissolved into the whole of the experience of life, where there is just the wave becomes the ocean and there is just life happening. And this has been talked about in various traditions in various ways for a very long time. And this is how I know to go about doing it. And I might have to adjust many times along the way. And so essentially I'm going to document, well, what does that actually look like? Or at least what does it look like for me? And I want to highlight the romantic side of it and these states and the beauty of seeking enlightenment. But I also want to highlight the rawness that I talked about of like, oh yeah, when I was with the monks, it was actually really difficult. And while I am removing myself from certain difficulties in life, I'm also stepping into other ones and at an amplified level. And I just want to show me genuinely, authentically going through that. And hopefully that is interesting to people and beneficial. And I'll show what helps me do that, what techniques, what ways of life and things that I avoid so as not to stimulate the mind to leave the moment. And so, you know, what is a supportive lifestyle of that? Yeah, I think that's a quick-ish version of what I'm
up to. So you're talking about essentially a self-imposed lockdown with no real idea about when you might emerge from that lockdown. This is a self-imposed lockdown where you are going to be essentially just with you alone for the most part, documenting the experience via video, I assume. Mm-hmm. How are you going to be documenting it?
Yeah, so it'll be video, and I'll have a primary camera, and then I'll have some secondary cameras, and I'll do some reflections every night of, you know, this is what the day was like. And then I'm also going to be doing a process called circling, which will be with other people. And that process is two or more people just becoming present with each other, and we drop in together, and we come and we commit to being in connection for about an hour. And we stay, and then we notice, you know, what is it like to be with you right now? What is it like to be me as I'm with you? What arises between us? And we follow that. Sometimes it's a lot of sensation. Sometimes it's emotion. Sometimes it's energy. Sometimes it's fun. Sometimes it's not. And so we just kind of, we follow that. And so.
And is the circling process on Zoom and in person, or a combination of the two, or is it one or the other? What does the circling process look like?
It's going to be mostly on Zoom. because I want this to be accessible to anyone, anywhere. And I circle with people in Canada, Brazil, different parts of the US and stuff. But I also have one or two people who are local who will probably come by and for their circling. So most of it will be online though.
And if anyone is interested in circling with you, how would they get in touch with you?
So all of this is going to be living on the new website for this called thegameofpresence.org. And on there will be everything from signing up for circling and the donations that I'm asking for that, which is actually how I'm funding this entire thing. So I hope a lot of people are interested in circling with me. I think it'll be a really good way for people who are interested, or at least maybe interested in seeing if they're interested, watch a few episodes and say, huh, this is different, or, ooh, this really, you know, resonates. And saying like, I want to practice this myself. And the best way that I've found is to practice it with someone who's a little bit ahead of them and can drop in with them. And we do it together so they can get a very, again, direct experience of that.
And if someone's listening to this and they're saying, well, this is very different, I don't know what that would entail, I'm not sure. I mean, this is different from going to a therapist. This is different from going to a coach. This is different from going to get my haircut. What am I contributing to? I would say the power that you as the potential second participant in the circling process, what you're going to get, my sense is you're going to get a really powerful transmission energetically that is coming through this engagement that might not be something that you can possibly describe or imagine, but I would imagine that given what you are stepping into, there will be something that is very palpable and might not be describable in words right now, but very much worth investing in if you are if you're on the fence about participating with Harry in the circling process. So I highly encourage you to go to thegiftofpresence.org. Is that what you said it was?
The game of presence.org.
So very powerful transmission is undoubtedly going to occur. So back to the process, back to the game. Any individuals who will be there in support of you in any kind of way, making meals, bringing you things? Will you be talking with anyone? Is this going to be a pretty much silent process the entire time? What is it going to look like?
It'll be mostly silent because I will be disconnected from technology for the most part, and emails and texts and calls and all those things. If there's an SOS that I have to answer, I will. But I will be taking one day off every 2 weeks to do some of the more worldly things, go grocery shopping, check in with family. I have some family that they have some medical stuff going on, and I want to keep the pulse on that and whatnot, and respond to some things, and mostly also spend that day with my editor and make sure that everything's going, you know, we're going to learn the whole time about, hey, how are we going to present this? What are how many episodes, how long, those types of things that are going to be on the go. So there will be some talking during that as well. But yeah, for the most part, if it's not in circling, I won't be talking very much at all. And then the support beyond that is that I am going to be working with a couple of different teachers who have been both teachers and peers to me over time, that kind of work in different realms. Two of them, I guess, are from the school of circling that I learned from. And they founded Circling Europe, and it's where I've gone, and they're great and amazing. And so I'm probably going to do a retreat with them every 6 months or something like that. And then also there's a guy called Bearheart and Bearheart Saputo, and he does work in nature and helps people connect with sacred fire and plant medicines and different things. And with him as well, I will be doing a retreat every 6 months or so to bring in some of those more amplified experiences. I am a fan of peak experience and beginning peak experience, but but only if there's integration and also a lot of practice in between those times. But I do enjoy that. And I, you know, I'm still growing and healing, and so having support, knowing that there is going to be support, is going to be really helpful as well.
I would imagine that someone might listen to you describe this and say, holy shit, like, how are you going to keep yourself from going crazy? But my sense is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that that's actually the very thing that you want to confront, is that tendency of the mind to feel crazy under these types of circumstances, and to be with that experience so fully that the crazy dissolves, and that aspect of the mind which could potentially go crazy can no longer have agency over your consciousness.
Yeah, that's another one of those topics where we could spend a few hours on the relationship between being in mind and all of that stuff. But I think the short answer is, yeah, it is definitely a part of what makes this really powerful. And simultaneously, what makes this also potentially dangerous. I wouldn't recommend someone who's newer to these types of this way of life to do something like what I'm doing. There's a reason that there are communities around this. There's reasons that I would not have been ready even a year ago to do this, let alone at the beginning of my journey. But I finally feel like I'm in a pocket where I've entered. I'm finally ready, but I also have so much further to go that I'm deeply called to this all in. But yeah, there, you know, when we talk about the power of the mind over identity and self and being, it's not a small thing. It's actually one of the most impactful things that we could actually talk about when it comes to our experience of reality. So dancing with it, yes, there is a part of like, okay, I'm going to confront parts of my psyche that I don't even know exist yet, I would imagine. But also learn to reorient my relationship to being so that it is not in the driver's chair anymore. And that can be wild, and it can be intense, and it can be wonderful all at the same time.
Mm. I like how you gave that disclaimer that this is not for the faint of heart, nor is it for the novice meditator to take on something like this. And I would agree. If you have zero experience, do not try this at home, folks. What Harry is about to embark on, especially with no real set time that you might emerge from this, it's a very intense experience. Do you have a sense at all? I don't know that you possibly could, but do you have a sense at all for when something inside of you says, okay, this is, it's complete? Do you have a sense for what that might feel like?
I can draw upon past experience, but I would imagine it's going to be slightly different. A very large part of this is a bit of full trust in self. Like, this is my all in trusting me. Mm-hmm. And so a part of that will be, if and when something does arise, trusting the discernment and the intuition of like, oh, is this me just trying to get out of something that I am in a painful moment I don't want to keep experiencing, or is this the true exit point? And maybe it comes through pain, I don't know, but like me in that moment of really being present to that shift in the river, so to say. It could look a lot of different ways, but I would imagine it'll come with quite a bit of clarity.
Well, we could go on and on about this for hours. I can't believe an hour has already passed. But I am really supportive and of the journey that you are embarking on. And folks, check out thegameofpresence.org and see how you can be involved, not only passively, but directly through this circling process with Harry, and reach out to Harry and learn more about how you can engage with him in this process. Harry, it's been a real pleasure chatting with you today. And I'm super psyched for you. I mean, I'm not even sure what I'm psyched for, but this is such a, and I know that you're not either. And you don't even know what you're getting into either. We can't know, but that's the beauty of it. It's the curiosity. It's the going into the unknown. And it's that courage and bravery that it takes to actually enter into the void of the unknown, rather than try to fill it with distractions and worldly things. And I so admire you for doing that. And this is just an awesome conversation. Dr. Fred Moss, if you're listening to this, we love you. We're sending you healing energy. Can't wait to have you back. Harry, thank you so much. TJ, thank you so much. I think that's a wrap. Again, folks, go to thegameofpresence.org to follow Harry's journey and contribute and be involved.
Thank you for having me on. This was amazing. I enjoyed it.
My pleasure. All right, take care.
Hello, everybody, and I just wanted to thank you for getting through another episode of True Voice with Dr. Fred. Wasn't that great? It is so much fun to interact with people and then interact with my listenership about really finding true voice and then bringing it forward. I really have never done anything more important than this, and I'm finally aligned with myself by helping others find their true voice. Let's find your alignment. What do you really want in your life?